Imagine backing your car out of the driveway on an ordinary morning and feeling that sickening bump beneath your tire. For Corby Malone, this horrific moment becomes the pivot point of his entire existence when he discovers he's run over his 2-year-old son Nico while under the influence of alcohol and Ativan. The accident occurs during a period of personal crisis, unemployed for months, secretly drinking instead of job hunting, and lying to his wife Emily about his activities. That fateful morning unfolds with excruciating detail. The resistance under the wheel, neighbors running toward him screaming, his son lying beneath the car in a pool of blood, while his twin sister Maisie remains safely strapped in her car seat. The aftermath is equally devastating. At the hospital, doctors deliver the news that Nico didn't survive, and Emily collapses in grief. Though initially tempted to lie about his intoxication, Cordy ultimately confesses to Detective Tunisia Sparks about drinking and taking prescription drugs before the accident. This honesty leads to his arrest for second-degree involuntary manslaughter and a 5-year prison sentence suspended after 3 years. As he's led away in handcuffs, Corby watches Emily leave the courtroom with her mother, beginning his journey through the criminal justice system as punishment for a tragedy he never intended, but for which he bears full responsibility. Corby and Emily's relationship began with summer promise in Mystic, Connecticut. Their first date of fried clams and an REM cover band ended with a moonlit beach kiss that felt like destiny. When she slipped her hand into mine that night, something clicked, Corby recalls. Despite living on opposite coasts, they maintained a long-distance relationship until eventually settling in Connecticut, where Emily taught elementary school and Corby worked as a graphic artist. In summer 2014, they decided to try for a baby, and Emily became pregnant with twins, bringing both joy and challenges. The novel contrasts these moments of connection with the unraveling following Nico's death. Emily's grief transforms into anger toward Corby, creating an unbridgeable distance. She banishes him from their bed, saying she doesn't trust him around Maisie. When Corby confesses his drinking and lying about job hunting, Emily tells him to leave, their once loving relationship disintegrating under tragedy, addiction, and unprocessed grief. Corby's entry into Yates Correctional Institution plunges him into a dehumanizing reality. The intake process, fingerprinting, strip search, delousing shower, and exchanging personal clothes for prison underwear immediately strips away his dignity. His tiny cell offers only a bleak view of dumpsters and rats through a narrow window. The prison enforces strict racial segregation, housing inmates by skin color. His first cellmate, a white supremacist named Pug, warns of an impending race war and demands Corby choose sides. Guards enforce arbitrary cruelties, terminating meals after 12 minutes, conducting retaliatory searches, and enforcing petty rules on whims. By his third week, Corby contemplates suicide. "I calculate I have 153 weeks left and don't think I can survive it," he admits. Only staff intervention prevents his attempt. Yet gradually, Corby finds unexpected connections. His second cellmate, Manny, becomes protective. He joins AA meetings, forms a poker group, secures a grounds crew job, and discovers the prison library, where librarian Faggy Millman offers encouragement and smuggled cookies. The Wakonic River, flowing behind Yates Correctional Institution, serves as a powerful metaphor throughout the novel, embodying both constancy and change, imprisonment and freedom. At 3 a.m., Corby listens to it, wondering whether its movement might be a spiritual sign that not everything is stagnant, that there's a path forward through my 3-year sentence back to my family. The river permeates Corby's thoughts, becoming his talisman in the form of a river stone he later shares with troubled inmate Solomon. It becomes central to his library mural, where he reimagines the prison as a natural paradise with the Wakonic flowing freely through it, depicting inmates floating on inner tubes and children skipping stones along its banks. Existing beyond the walls, the river represents ongoing life outside awaiting Corby's return, while suggesting the patience and inevitability of time's passage. Throughout his imprisonment, art becomes Corby's lifeline, a means of processing grief, maintaining humanity, and creating meaning from tragedy. As a former graphic artist, he uses Emily's gift of a sketchbook to create a story for Maisie about a giraffe connecting with his daughter despite their separation. The transformative power of art culminates in Corby's library mural project, reimagining the prison as a natural paradise. This undertaking becomes his salvation, allowing him to process emotions while creating beauty amid ugliness. The finished piece includes meaningful figures, fellow inmates, Emily and Maisie on a distant path, and Nico with monarch butterflies emerging from his head. During the unveiling, librarian Mrs. Millman explains how art allows viewers to both lose and find themselves, particularly significant for imprisoned men seeking growth. The mural attracts media attention and connects Corby with an art agent offering future work. Art transforms suffering into something meaningful, a visual testimony acknowledging pain while pointing toward possibility. Addiction permeates the narrative, starting with Corby's secret drinking that contributes to the accident. His substance abuse stems from unemployment, humiliation, using alcohol to mask inadequacy. In prison, Corby commits to sobriety despite constant temptation. When cellmate Manny reveals hidden tequila, Corby narrowly escapes relapse when his thumb accidentally punches through his cup. The novel portrays recovery as a daily battle. At prison AA meetings, inmates share familiar advice: talk to sponsors, pray for strength, move a muscle, change a thought. One warns that while they're inside, their addiction is doing push-ups in the yard, a vivid metaphor for addiction's persistence. Corby's sobriety faces its greatest test after being sexually assaulted by guards. The trauma leads him to accept a Klonopin prescription despite his addiction history, causing a failed drug test before early release, illustrating recovery's fragility when complicated by trauma. In the novel's final section, Emily visits Corby's prison mural with 7-year-old Maisie in 2023, 3 years after the main narrative. Now pregnant and engaged to Brian from her grief group, the visit honors Corby while embracing their new life. Before the artwork, Emily traces the brushstrokes and speaks to Corby, apologizing for ignoring his addiction, infrequent prison visits, and her harsh reaction to his failed drug test. Though building a new life, she promises he won't be forgotten. The poignant climax comes when Maisie asks to see something atop the mural. Using a step stool, she reaches toward a small green chrysalis containing Nico surrounded by butterflies. "Hello, boy," she says, high-fiving her twin's image as Emily feels her unborn daughter move. This moment suggests that while tragedy leaves permanent marks, it doesn't prevent new beginnings. Life continues flowing like the river in Corby's mural, sometimes gentle, sometimes turbulent, but always moving forward. Even after devastating loss, light can emerge through acceptance and the courage to live fully despite permanent scars.